Welcome to the Lift Every Voice podcast, where we explore books by contemplative writers of color. I'm Christine Walters-Paintner.
And I'm Claudia Love Meyer. We are joined each month by the author of our book club selection. Together, we explore how increasing our diversity of perspectives on contemplative practice can enrich our experience of the Christian mystical tradition.
We encourage you to join us by reading the book, listening to the conversations, and engaging with the reflection questions on our website at abbeyofthearts.com. Welcome, everybody, to our Lift Every Voice book club. We are really delighted to have the Reverend Tyler Sitt here with us. His book, Staying Awake, The Gospel for Changemakers, is our featured book this month. Woo! And I highly encourage you. Woo, we all have it. We've all read the book. So I just want to do a little brief introduction. So Tyler has had the immense pleasure of being the church planter of New City Church, a church that focuses on environmental justice. And he talks about the church a great deal in the book. It's in Minnesota. He's a United Methodist pastor and the son of a Chinese immigrant. And he also earned his Master of Divinity from Candler School of Theology and has lived on four continents. And I haven't yet found out what those four are, so to work that in. And he's also trained as a prison chaplain and a community organizer and a social entrepreneur. So welcome, Tyler. It's really wonderful to have you here with us.
So glad to be with all of you.
Thanks, Tyler. Claudia, do you want to kick us off in our conversation?
I do. So, Tyler, we read that you wanted to be a pastor since you were 17 years old. So I was wondering if you could share about your journey from realizing that you're gay to being the church planter and pastor that you are today.
Oh, yeah. So I knew that I was gay before I knew that I was going to be a pastor. That was like, I remember being in like elementary school and watching Michael Jackson's Black or White music video, you know, the one, and seeing a backup dancer and being like, I bet I'm noticing this guy in a way that is different from how like my dad might be noticing him or my brother might be noticing him. That's interesting. So like kind of, I mean, by fifth grade, I was like very sure that I was gay. And I also had a lovely church community that deeply grounded me in faith. And so when I was in fifth grade, I started reading the Bible like cover to cover, like start with Genesis 1, read all the way to Revelation, start over. And I had like a little fifth grade commentary of me talking about what I thought about the Bible. And that was always kind of how it went together for me, like kind of the energy and the life force of sexuality. And then the kind of vertical alignment of faith have always been interconnected for me. And I kind of thought about it like a tomato vine and a trellis. Like my sexuality is like a vine that's growing and my faith is like a trellis that kind of helps to give some structure and meaning and vertical alignment to it. So that was just kind of always my personal relationship with that. And when I was in junior year of high school, I was making dinner with my Minnesotan mom. Okay, you guys. And she was, we were making up some hot dish or something and we were cooking up and chopping. And she was like, you know, Tyler, you could do what Pastor Robert does on Sundays. You would be really good at that. And it was like, head exploding. Like, of course, that's what God put me on this world to do. And so from there, it's just always been like kind of this journey towards ministry that brought me all over the world, that put me into different professions, but like all professional trainings, I should say. But ultimately, I always knew that pastoring was the thing for me.
I love that your mother called that forth from you.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. It's a whole long story, but my whole vocational journey is basically punctuated by like wise women in my life who mystically saw me and then named something about me that kind of changed everything.
Beautiful.
Some point that you felt like your denomination or other Christians were hostile to you? Not like hostile, like mean to you, but kind of it gave you that side eye because you were queer.
Yeah. I mean, I would say hostile is an appropriate word. Like, all the way down to like just walking down the sidewalk and people yelling things out of their car at me and yelling slurs and bullying and different types of abuse and intimidation. But I've also always had, and this is a privilege for a lot of queer people, I've always had like a mentor or an adult or someone in my life who was in my corner and who said like, this is not something to be ashamed of. This is not a social liability. And this is not like a sign that God has abandoned you. In fact, like it's a sign that God loves you. And so like, I think that I've been able to weather a lot of things in large part because of the community of elders in my life, many of whom are people of faith. So I think that part of the reason why I believe so much in the power of church is because I myself have been able to survive like some pretty hard things because of people of faith.
Beautiful. Really
beautiful. Yeah, I'm really touched by that. You start your book by talking about inviting us to become not just doers of justice, but beings of justice, which that was really beautiful. And, and obviously the book revolves around different practices at which, you know, at Abbey of the Arts, our focus has always been more on the embodiment of faith as opposed to what you believe. I don't particularly care what people believe unless it sort of interferes with other people's sort of livelihoods. But I wonder, there's a little section, it's page XXXIII, and I just thought it was really beautifully written. So I wondered if you could read, if you could read that paragraph. This is why the people.
Yeah. This is why the people following Jesus came up with practices long before they came up with a written set of beliefs. They knew that if their days were to amount to more than business as usual, they would need habits so deeply ingrained within them that they would stay strong even when people threatened them. They knew that the stakes were high and that if prayer were reduced to a hollow pleasantry, then they'd already lost. They prayed to mend what was broken, revive what had been stepped on, and reconnect what had been disrupted.
Thank you for that. It just was really beautifully put how you kind of wove all that together. And I wonder if you can just share a little bit more about how that your commitment to practice as a way of being justice came about and how it became sort of the foundation of your congregation or your community.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think that every queer person has to look at their life and trust, I should say every queer person in a hostile environment has to look at their life and trust that their experience has some measure of truth in it, even if that truth is invalidated by the social discourse. And so I think from a really early age as a queer person, I sensed God. I had a connection to God. Like many children, there was kind of like this awe and wonder in my life. And that experience is what really gave me a spiritual mooring for navigating some chaotic moments in my life. And so I think that one of the real spiritual frailties of American Christianity is that it mimics white supremacist culture in putting forward language and words as the primary basis for faith. Mm-hmm. And that creates, that it kind of creates a very fragile system, because if we intellectually believe something but don't experientially believe something, and then that intellectual belief is disproven or argued in a different way, there's not kind of a body way of knowing to for us to fall back on. And that's why we're seeing so many people, like, you know, rise in this faith, become super obsessed with kind of this American, especially I'm thinking of conservative evangelicalism, mm-hmm. and then kind of like rapidly burning out and falling away from it in a way that's resulting in a lot of resentment for the church. A lot of the people who come to New City Church are folks who kind of flamed out from the conservative evangelical culture, not because God wasn't there, but because there was a certain theology, there was a certain like creedal set of beliefs that they knew they couldn't abide with once they became friends with a gay person, or realized that they were trans, or realized that anti-racism discourse and what was being preached about what didn't align. And so we see this huge collapse. And when we base faith off of primarily off of experience, that collapse doesn't happen.
Yeah. Go ahead, Claudia.
Oh, no, I was just gonna ask him the next question. You go.
I was just gonna say, I'm struck by that in part, because I think about even just the word God, you know, we all bring our own experience to that word. So even using that word is, I find, not a particularly helpful word sometimes, because every one of us is interpreting that from a different perspective. And to come at it, you know, what is your experience of that divine connection, is a much more nurturing and nourishing way of talking about faith. So thank you for that.
Yeah. I'm going to be a little transparent with this next question. So on my Twitter feed, and some personal friends of mine, there are all these stories about people who have been, you know, they didn't just get their feelings hurt. They were actually abused in their churches and traumatized in their churches. And some of them want nothing to do with church, even though they still love Jesus. In my case, and I haven't been to church in a while, my son was molested by a deacon at my church. And for a while, I was able to go to church, but, you know, it was kind of in fits and starts. Because that's really traumatic, and it affected my son, you know, in the worst ways. So what would you tell Christians who are truly, truly traumatized? You know, there was sexual abuse, there was gaslighting, you know, things that really hurt the soul.
Yeah. Well, first, Claudia, I just want to apologize and say I'm so sorry that happened to your son. That wasn't right of that deacon, and it was a misrepresentation of the liberation that God wants for us. And, you know, we want churches to be a place of growth and healing, and for kids to be able to become everything that God made them to be. And that deacon really stole that from your son. And I'm so sorry to hear that. Just appalled. So thank you for being vulnerable and sharing that. I think that there's a lot of people at New City Church. I'm sorry, were you gonna?
Oh, no, I was just going to circle back to, you know, what would you say to people like us?
Yeah, so there's a lot of folks at New City Church who have had pretty traumatic experiences. And I think when we look at any other type of trauma, it can help us understand how we should approach religious or church-based trauma. So for example, I am I've worked with several folks who are survivors of sexual trauma or like domestic abuse trauma. And there's some folks who are like, because of this trauma, I'm just going to kind of write this out of my life forever. Like, I'm just not going to create intimacy systems. And of course, like, I can't decide what healing looks like for them. So I bless them on that journey. But for most of the folks that I know who have experienced trauma, they don't want to cut that part of themselves off or completely remove themselves from anything that has to do with intimacy or sexuality, but rather they want to experience a healing, a whole version of the thing that traumatized them so that they can create a new pathway. So it's like, yes, I would, folks might say I'm a survivor of sexual trauma and I want to have sex with someone who like really values consent and really values my boundaries and really can treat me respectfully. And it's more healing to experience a positive version of the thing than to not have the thing at all. And so for church trauma, of course, it's people's choice. And if your son decided to never come back to church, I think that would be understandable. And I think that for a lot of people who have experienced church abuse and church trauma, being in a community that practices healthy faith and healthy religion often is more healing than if they never came to church at all. And so I try to put on the forefront of New City Church, how New City is trying to be a trauma-informed community. So all the time during worship, I'm like, hey, if you grew up with this kind of narrative, then this might be kind of troubling for you. And this is how we're addressing that. I also, especially when we're talking about hard topics, give people permission to leave the room. Like, if you want to watch church from the lobby, it's totally fine for you to move around. If you need to get a glass of water, if you need to go for a walk, we want you to kind of honor the instincts that your body put in to defend yourself. Because if that isn't recognized, then how in the heck are we going to connect to God? So I think we try our best to do that. And of course, we make mistakes along the way like anyone. But I do think that it is the task of anyone running any community of faith in 2022 to really think through how their experience can be trauma-informed, because experiences like your son's are unfortunately too common.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to touch on, you talk about toxic masculinity, because I thought that might connect well to what we were just talking about. And in your chapter on worship, you describe it as when we men weaponize stereotypes of masculinity, like being forceful or unfeeling, to perilous effects on other people, the planet, and ourselves. So I really appreciated how you, you know, acknowledged how it touches kind of all dimensions of our lives. And I wonder, how you work with that in your church in an intentional way. And in particular, I'm curious about if you've worked with any men or seen any transformational moments where men who were really participating in that way of thinking and being in the world were able to see themselves through a different lens and perhaps transform that pattern that I think is so deeply ingrained in our culture, you know, to push down our feeling states and to not acknowledge grief and, you know, all of that kind of, or intimacy or long for connection and all of those kinds of things.
Yeah. What I found interesting is, you know, we're in South Minneapolis. So this is a very progressive or even like further left than progressive neighborhood. The men who choose to live here are generally aligned with a certain level of discourse or politic. So it's not like I'm talking to like the Fox, like the boomer Fox News anchor about toxic masculinity. You know, it's like, you know, the folks who are around here are like at least intellectually aligned with the discourse. What I think is an interesting struggle for a lot of the cisgender men in at New City Church is we do a lot of prayers that have to do with emotions. And I preach a lot about emotions. And I talk about how emotions are kind of helpful in pointing us towards God. And if we engage our heart fully, then that enriches our faith. And I've heard from men, not saying I disagree with you, Tyler, but saying like, when I try to turn to my heart, it's like watching a TV with just static on it. Like, I don't know how to interpret or even mm-hmm. like name how
or I'm access, feeling, yeah,
or access that at all. And so despite trying, you know, like despite like agreeing intellectually and wanting this to be the case, I just hear like there's some like blockage there. And so I think that sometimes men who are in that spot have a hard time at New City because we have this whole sermon series or this whole book study or whatever on a certain type of data or sensation that they're like, I trust that this exists, but I don't really know what it means to like fully embrace my heart. And I think that that has experientially been a real struggle for some of the men at New City. And knowing that, I try to really take baby steps of like, okay, we're gonna take it real slow and real gentle. And it's okay if you mess up or feel like you're making a fool out of yourself.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it's healing just to be in a community where other people are able to, you know, just to embody, you know, being able to access feelings and speak about them and have them acknowledged and all of that, you know, just being in that kind of culture.
Yeah. And naming, you know, I think that sometimes emotions and justice are set against each other. Mm-hmm. Like if we're really just doing inner work or if we're really addressing ourselves, then we're not doing the hard work that we're supposed to be doing. We're not getting out there. Or vice versa, you know, if we're like active, then we're not really allowed. If we're on the streets, we're not really allowed to like have a public conversation about how vulnerable we feel or that kind of thing. And I feel like the way of Jesus is like both of those things fully at the same time. And that's how we pursue holiness in the world. So
Yeah, beautiful.
I had this online community, and when I spoke to them, the last thing I would say is you are loved, you are held, you are blessed. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so beautiful how God meets us, how Jesus meets us in our suffering. This is very, very hard times in this world. And also it's a time where there is knowledge that may not have been so readily available 20 years ago or 30 years ago, where we have language for our trauma. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about that beautiful, welcoming prayer. And even though we may feel vulnerable, lead us in that prayer.
Yeah, yeah. Let's practice it. You know, like this whole book is about practice, not just talking about stuff, but doing stuff. So let's practice some welcoming prayer. And usually this would be a prayer that I would do written because I'm just like such an intensely visual person that is helpful for me to do it written. But we can also do it as a community, just spoken aloud. So I invite you to plant your feet on the ground if that feels comfortable, and maybe just to like kind of notice your room and reorient yourself to where you are and what's going on. Notice the temperature of the air and notice kind of the texture of the things that you're touching right now, maybe the seat that is supporting you. And I invite you to just get in touch with your breath a little bit. The first step of welcoming prayer is to say welcome to whatever emotion you're feeling. And I'm asking you to be brave because there are some emotions that you like to acknowledge more than others. And this is an opportunity to say welcome, whether it be sadness or excitement. I'm kind of feeling some like Outward Energy because I'm doing an interview. So welcome, Outward Energy. Whatever kind of emotions you've had throughout the day, whatever kind of morning you had, welcome, welcome. And when it feels like you've acknowledged an emotion into the room, you kind of, as if you're sitting across from them and just enjoying a cup of tea together, create space for the emotion to say what it's trying to say. So without judging whether it is right or wrong or correct or you agree with, just allowing the emotion to say whatever it's going to say. For that outward emotion, I might feel like I have to put a lot of energy into this interview, otherwise it won't seem like I'm talking about something that's true. Whether or not that's true, I'm just welcoming it. Hello, welcome. Thanks for being here. Letting your sadness speak, or your grief, or your happiness, or your joy, the whole spectrum of emotions. And once you feel like all the emotions that are present in your lived experience right now have had a chance to speak, the next step is to say, thank you. Thank you, happiness. Thank you, energy. Thank you, shame. Thank you, grumpy, whatever you might be feeling. This changes the power dynamic because a lot of times our emotions come in with so much intensity that it feels like they're running our lives, that we're just at the puppet strings of these emotions. And this prayer helps remind us that we are welcoming the emotions into our home, that the emotions are guests that we can entertain. These emotions are trying to tell us something in particular. But ultimately, we can ask the emotions to leave. We can show them to the door once they've said their truth. And we can remember that the emotions all have a part of the story, a part of the truth or reality, not the whole story. And so we can accept the truth that's within that, while knowing that that's not telling the whole picture. And once we feel like our emotions, if I'm having kind of a big emotion kind of day, I might stay in this stage for a long time. And once I feel like each emotion has had a chance to say their piece, I turn to God and say, what do you think, God? Acknowledging that God is a God of liberation, a God of hope, a God of wholeness. And when we allow God to speak into our lives, it illumines all of our being. So opening ourselves up to God, we might hear how God responds to the sadness that you're feeling or the joy. And sometimes it takes a little while to feel like you know that God is responding to you. Sometimes it requires a little bit of trust or faith. But people can't hurry God. So if it takes a little bit of time, that's okay. Just listen. I go through this process again and again, welcoming in new emotions that come up until it feels like I'm kind of in a resting spot, that often big emotions can kind of pass through once they feel like their piece has been said. And I can say, amen.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I have one more question along those lines. I know I'm going to sound tragedy prone. Honestly, I'm not. But last year was the worst year of my life. Mm-hmm. My son passed away from an overdose 4.5 months ago. And the last time we did an exercise like this, an exercise that I've done several times, I completely fell apart because I felt like I needed to protect all of the, you know, keep all of these emotions in, because if I didn't, I would get swallowed up from them and never return. So I'm sure that in doing this prayer with someone and they experience something like I experienced that time, even though I had done that several times before, how do you walk beside them as they are feeling these big emotions that they are welcoming, but they're so, so big and so, so hard and so difficult to do by themselves?
One of the folks at New City who has experienced a lot of trauma in her life, names, like, when I feel like I welcome in emotions, I feel like it's like a pack of wild dogs is attacking me, or it feels like I'm on fire, or, you know, it's a kind of like, oh, I'm no longer in control of this situation. And I said, okay, so for someone who is kind of going through your situation or where you're at, what do you think would be a more helpful welcoming prayer? And she said, when those emotions come up, if it feels like it's like so much that it's kind of that overflowing place, maybe just pausing there and allowing a lot of self-compassion to take place. So even if the emotion is like, oh, I'm not done talking yet, being like, okay, wow, it sounds like that was really hard, or it sounds like this was a really painful time for you, and I'm so sorry that it was painful for you. God hears our prayers, and God collects our tears, and it sounds like connecting to a God of deep compassion is what we need right now. So let's just like welcome in the gentle love of God, and kind of just like a little bit putting pause on emotions that are like so big for the sake of being able to practice a little bit of self-compassion. I thought that was insightful. That's what she said. And then I would also just say, after any significant trauma event, seeking out mental health, professional mental health, is always a good idea. And maybe doing this practice with, if your mental health practitioner is a person of faith, like doing this prayer with them so that there's someone who can kind of catch you and guide you in this in a professionally trained way.
Thank you. That's beautiful.
Yeah. I love the welcoming prayer, and I love the way that you just led that, Tyler. It was really, the languaging was really beautiful. And I think it gave me just another way there to meet, a part of myself today. So that was really sweet. And then to have God hold that, was really beautiful. So I'm grateful to you for that. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about, you talk about spiritual practices being so central, and you talk about prayer are like daily visits with God to build up a relationship and realign yourself with God's deep desires for the world. Spiritual practices are disciplined truth-telling and truth-listening. So I wonder, do you have like a practice right now that for you as a pastor or as a human being, or, you know, that's really feels really, really essential to you right now to sustain you through all that's happening in the world? And
certainly, I mean, I do pages and pages of welcoming prayer every day, because every day it seems like, you know, beyond just society and kind of like the huge difficult news that that we're experiencing as a society, I'm a pastor who is creating space for people to name really, really hard, unprocessed emotions and truths in their life. And it's like, you know, that impact, I'm a person, and that impacts me. Yeah. So I think that a lot of times what I find is, even unknowingly, I kind of like stuff some of the emotions into a backpack, or kind of like, okay, wow, that was really messed up. I have my next interview or my next thing, so I got to get going. And the morning is the time when I unpack the backpack and say like, wow, you know, that was really hurtful. And there's an invitation of action that is coming from welcoming prayer. Interestingly, welcoming prayer is so emotions-based, but most of my wisest actions come from welcoming prayer, because when I lay everything out on the table, it's like, oh, well, this is obviously what I need to do. So mostly that, but also nature, also tidying, big fan of throwing away things that are no longer providing joy into my life, like mm-hmm. that kind of thing for sure.
A little spring cleaning time. Yeah.
Non-stop spring cleaning. I love it.
I was just spring cleaning all morning. So I just want to touch on one other practice that you, because you write a whole chapter about Sabbath, which to me also feels like, for me personally, I think one of the most important of all of the spiritual practices, because it's so disruptive of the cultural message to keep working and productivity to be the center of our identity. And especially as someone who's self-employed, there's always work to do. And so I find Sabbath to be, I often talk about, the most important and the hardest practice, you know, together. And so how do you, I love that you talked about, you know, the mindset in our culture is work, 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 so that we can then rest and play on the weekend. But the Sabbath message is really to reverse that, and that we actually work to build up to the rest is the centerpiece of everything. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that and as a practice, and how do we embody that in a world that demands so much of us?
Yeah, so I think, first off, as a social justice, someone who's trying to pursue justice in the world, and as an organizer, I want to name that constant busyness is one of the tools of empire to stop people from rising up. Because if folks are always worrying about the next thing, that makes it a lot harder to ask bigger questions of why we're in the situation that we're in the first place, what policies have led to the situations that we're in, how might we imagine a more preferable future where our needs can be met? Like, those bigger things are really hard to attend to when it's like, okay, I gotta keep going if I'm gonna go, you know? And so like everyone at New City has like three or four jobs. And it's like, whether or not this was the intention, that's a really good way to suppress revolution. Because if everyone's working four jobs, then how in the world are they going to schedule in, you know, these bigger conversations? So Sabbath is a revolutionary act, because it affords us time to rest in God, to find rest in God, when society wants to constantly objectify and extract value from us. And I think that, like, in comparison to Sabbath kind of being like, you know, we talk about rest, like it's kind of this like associated with privilege. We can go on retreats. The people who can go on the mountain can afford to go on the mountain. The people who get to, and that's not the biblical imagination of rest at all. Like it's very clear in Exodus, like even animals, the land, people who are enslaved, like everyone gets to enjoy rest as a society, because all of us are better off because of it. And that's the revolution. Like we don't earn rest. Rest is something that is like coded into our being as a humanity and as a civilization. And once we get that, so many more things naturally become available to us, including justice.
Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you for that. Yes, I'm all on board for the revolution. I'm gonna take a nap first.
in the front of the book, you tell us about your experience of being right there in the center of protest around the murder of George Floyd. I live here in Kentucky. where Breonna Taylor lived. And of course, we protested as well. And there were elements, you know, even though the protesters, as you know, are going in to be peaceful, it was not always peaceful. It was not always safe. And unfortunately, this trend that has been going on forever of the police hurting Black and brown people, it's going to happen again. How do we get on the front lines like you were, if we are, of course, physically capable of doing that? How do we express our passion? And I know you couldn't guarantee that if you go to a protest, you'll be safe. Mm-hmm. But how do we begin to get out there and have this experience not be performative, to release our passion for justice, if we've never done anything like that, and we are afraid even before we get there? How do we begin?
Yeah. So I have a lot of thoughts on this, so I'm trying to condense this down. One, I think outrage is a reasonable emotional response to systems of oppression and violence. So, I mean, in Minneapolis, Amira Locke was murdered a couple weeks ago from a no-knock warrant, which, following the murder of Breonna Taylor last year, the mayor said that he had banned no-knock warrants. And then here we are with another young Black man getting murdered in his apartment, lying on a couch with a comforter over him from a no-knock warrant. And I think that is unacceptable. And at its baseline, all of any response or any protest should be this or that or whatever need to be secondary to the argument. Like, that is unacceptable. And as a society, we cannot rest as long as something that is so blatantly wrong is going on. Like, our soul depends on us stopping those types of incidents from happening again. So that's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is elders in the movement are a really important function of social justice. People who have pounded the pavement, who have been on the front lines, who have been really prominent in protests, I think are really, really important. People who have survived decades of this, because for a lot of the folks who are going to the protests that I'm attending are 20 somethings, who are for some folks, this is their first 3 years of protesting, and it's hard to know what to expect or how to gauge expectations or how things actually work or how society works. And of course, that's refreshing, because it kind of adds an urgency that is a corrective to being complacent. But also, I found elders as being the best at being able to transfer hot anger into cold anger. Hot anger is I'm so filled with rage that my body is going to move harmfully in any way that I see possible. And cold anger is I will never accept injustice, but I'm going to bring friends along with me. I'm going to create a movement and build a base. I'm going to be precise about what is actually going to make a difference and push in that way. And I've found the most healing to come from elders in that.
Mm-hmm. I really like that distinction. Oh, Claudia, you're muted.
I'm sorry, there's a party going on. And I didn't want you guys to hear it. That's amazing and so helpful, because we do have the hot anger, some of us, and then the cold anger, which feels to me like it would be more intentional. And I'm more drawn to that kind of thing. I think that was what I was experiencing in the first place. I didn't go to Brianna's protest during the pandemic, but I have protested before, and I'm in Lexington, Kentucky. It was so lame. It was like no danger whatsoever, but I really like those words of wisdom. Thank you.
Tyler, as we kind of come towards the end of our time, I wanted to touch on your last practice of church planting, which I found was an intriguing practice to include as one of your kind of core practices, mostly because I don't come from a culture of church planting. But as I read, I realized actually our Abbey the Arts community is very much exactly what you were describing. So it was sort of a nice way to kind of reframe it and see it through that. And you talk about, you know, as opposed to kind of the colonization model of like forceful domination and conquest, you know, that church planting is about creating these spaces of life, of abundance, where God's dream for the world can become a little more obvious. So beautiful. You have a lot of beautiful phrasing in your book, which I appreciate. And you go on to describe them as sanctuaries of sacred composting. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about that and just how people might feel empowered to create their own sacred community that embodies these practices, you know, that are so life-giving.
I am a trained church planter. I've gone through like boot camps, which like, why are we calling church starting things boot camps? Like, what does that even mean? I've read hundreds of books about church planting. I've started an organization, Intersect Co-Planting Network, to help church planters plant in an anti-racist and LGBTQ affirming way. And what I found is that a lot of times church planting gets talked about kind of like as a conservative evangelical thing, like starting new communities, all the conferences, high profile, expensive conferences, all the literature is like white guys who are like, I want to start my little fiefdom. And so let me just like go and colonize a place. And I'm going to put Jesus's name on it. And I think that was a little harsher than I intended it to be, but I have a lot of feelings about that. But I think that what I try to argue in my book is like, marginalized people have to church plant out of survival. Like, we always have to create spaces of survival. We always have to create spaces to do the sacred composting of like, okay, I have these experiences and they're going to kill me unless I'm in community and figuring this out. And church planting is just a natural outpouring of living in the gospel. Like, creating spaces of survival and liberation is a natural outpouring of following Jesus.
Mm. That's so beautiful. I want to go to your church, Tyler. I'm going to have to come visit in Minnesota sometime.
Well, and we do have an online service. So people can always join us Sunday mornings.
Of course, one of the gifts of the pandemic is we can visit church anywhere these days. Yeah. That's lovely. Well, yeah, thank you.
I want to create your church.
Yeah.
I want to plant your church.
Yes.
Yeah.
We can talk about that. And certainly anyone who's interested in planting something similar to New City could check out Intersect Co-Planting Network, where I put up training materials for doing exactly that. So
that's amazing, Tyler. Thank you so much. It's been really just a delight to talk with you. And I love your book, Staying Awake, The Gospel for Changemakers. Make sure to buy your copy and read it. And we'll have questions up for you to ponder during the month. And yeah, just thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. Just a joy.
God bless everyone. Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.